In the infinite inning, cruelty has no boundaries, and even a kiss can feel like a blow. Okay, wait, I can't do that one with a straight face. That's way overdramatic. Really, this story is kind of a trifle. I love it anyway because it shows the lengths that a player will sometimes go to not play. We love the game. Most of the players love the game. But you can love something and still have it grow monotonous because it's hard work or because you've just done a lot of it, like played 154 games or 162, depending on the era. And maybe you need a couple of minutes alone. It doesn't mean you don't love your wife. You just need a little space just now, just for a few minutes. And similarly, some of us can eat pizza 5 days in a row, but not six. It's easy to forget that players in the early days were not making millions of dollars a year, still had to work in the off season. They weren't necessarily playing the game because it was a game, but because that was how they were going to survive economically. And all of us, no matter how much we love our jobs, have days where we just don't feel like dealing with work. Players are no different, unless they're just Cal Ripken Jr. or Lou Gehrig, I guess. And parenthetically, do you remember that series of documentaries that ran on HBO and other channels when it was a game? They featured found footage, color home movies of ball players from yesteryear, from pre-television. They were very cool when you could identify the player. They didn't always caption things. So, okay, we know Ted Williams, we know Babe Ruth, but some of the other guys, it would have been nice to know who they were. But the bigger problem is the title, When It Was a Game. That was exactly when it wasn't a game, the 20s, 30s, 40s. That's when, and for a while longer after that, it was about making money and surviving so you could feed your family. One borderline great early player who was not always wholly devoted to feeding himself or his family because there were days he just didn't feel like it was Bad Bill Dahlen. I've talked about him before. He's probably the best shortstop not in the Hall of Fame. He played in the majors from 1891 through 1909 with a couple of cameos in his 40s when he was a manager. If you look up his stats, they don't look that special to us because he played in the dead ball era. But he was a robust hitter for a middle infielder most of the time, and his reputation as a fielder was superb. The Giants acquired him in 1904, late in his career, and he was pretty much done as a hitter, but he could still pick it in the field, and John McGraw said it was one of the best moves he ever made. The team went from 84 wins to 106 wins, and Dahlen wasn't all of that, but he was part of it. Thing is, even though he's still 12th on the all-time list of games played at shortstop, he didn't always feel like playing. But then, as I imagine it is now, unless you were Ricky Henderson, it's still hard to go to your manager and just say, I'm not that into it today, and also, I really want to go see the Avengers movie today at 1. I realize that's when the ball game is supposed to start, but I also have a date tonight, and it's 3 hours long. I'm not going to be able to get to it then, so I think now would be the best time. I'm not great with this pitcher anyway, to be honest. I'd probably strike out 3 times in 5 at-bats. Play the kid. Play the bench guy. It's all right. I'll see ya. Goodbye. The way Dahlen arranged to get to where he wanted to go without asking to leave the ball game was to provoke the umpire into ejecting him, and then no one could argue if he just got dressed and left, I guess. He was ejected 34 times as a player and also 34 times as a manager. And I don't want to give you the impression that all those ejections were calculated so he could get to the Avengers film, or in his case, the track is what it was. Some of them were the result of the fact that he was legitimately a very scrappy kind of player, but he never did learn that that's not helpful. The 34 ejections as a manager is spectacularly impressive because he only managed 615 games. He was ejected from 6% of all games that he managed. Casey Stengel, who played for Dahlen as a rookie, told a story about his own career that when he was managing in the minors at Toledo, which was his first high-profile managerial job, he used to get ejected all the time. And the owners finally sat him down and explained that they were paying him to manage, not to sit in the stands on suspension in his suit and tie. so that they would rather he back down on a few arguments if it meant he could actually do his job effectively. And he got the message. Casey was ejected 40 times as a manager in the majors, but he managed so many games, that's only 1% of the time, as opposed to Dolan's, you know, every 3 days. So journey with me and Bill Dolan to September 1907. From September 23rd through September 25th of that season, the New York Giants played the Pirates at Pittsburgh. As the date suggests, it was towards the end of the season, and the two teams weren't exactly focused. At least the Giants weren't. It wasn't a bad addition to the team by any means, and the Pirates were good too, with Hans Wagner having another huge season. His .350 batting average, .408 on base percentage, and .513 slugging works out in context to a .187 OPS plus. You don't see that often. The Cubs, though, were just dominant that year. They ran away with the league, winning 107 games. Both the Pirates and the Giants, by September, being decent, had locked up a share of the first division money, so really there wasn't a whole lot at stake except pride for both teams. Well, the Giants didn't play with a whole lot of pride. According to the game stories, they played a very sloppy series, especially when it came to self-discipline. In the first game, the umpire, the old arbiter, as they called him, Bill Clem, had to throw out McGraw and third baseman Art Devlin. And in the second game, he threw out four Giants, among them pinch hitter Frank Bowerman, who was chucked for arguing balls and strikes. And think about it, how often does a pinch hitter get tossed? He doesn't get to finish the one thing that he was asked to do. What's stranger still about that is that the box score shows that Bowerman got a hit. So did Clem eject him after he reached first? Did he turn around and start arguing balls and strikes while he was standing on the bag or while he was running down the line? It's very confusing to me, as is Bill Dolan's intentions in the third game. That was his spotlight moment. I can only guess that as the events I'm about to describe happened, Clem was pretty sore after two rough days of being yelled at by New York Giants, and maybe Dolan was trying to ease the tension with a little humor in his own way, or alternatively, he was trying to goad Clem even more. All I know for certain is that Dolan was batting in the top of the third, the Giants were already down 7-0, when one of his teammates, the outfielder George Brown, emerged from the dugout carrying a bouquet of flowers. We're more than 100 years from this event, so feel free to hyperbolize if you want, and picture a huge floral arrangement, or alternatively, just a few wan daisies in his hand. I'm not really sure. I just know he strode up to home plate carrying flowers, and he offered them to Bill Dolan. Dolan said, "No, no, they're not for me. They're for Clem." So Brown turned, I guess, and offered the umpire a bouquet of flowers. Maybe he got down on one knee. I don't really know. The only thing I know for certain is that we who are alive today and watch the game in the present day have never seen the like. Clem refused the flowers, and the game went on, at least for a moment. Sometimes this gets written up as Clem having automatically ejected Dolan for this prearranged stunt of presenting him with flowers, but that's not how it happened. I imagine Clem trying to talk himself into staying calm. Okay, they're only flowers, just a little joke. He's trying to goad you. He's trying to get you to fly off the handle. Don't give the little bastard the satisfaction. Stay calm, carry on, keep the ball game moving along. All right, batter up. So Brown goes back to the dugout with his flowers. I don't know what happened to them. I'd like to say that the Hall of Fame asked for the flowers, but of course the Hall of Fame had not been invented yet. Dolan steps in. He gets ready to hit. The pitcher delivers. Clem says, "Strike." And Dolan said something that was probably a little like, "Strike, are you kidding? That was a foot outside." And Clem said, "That's it." And that, boys and girls, is how Bill Dolan got ejected on that day from that game. Bill just had to push things that extra inch, and Clem was past the point of letting him have it. There's a lesson in there. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's this. There used to be an ad slogan that said, "Say it with flowers." And you can say it with flowers, but it would behoove you to say it with flowers only and keep your mouth shut insofar as adding anything else. That's good advice, and so all I will add now myself is, I'm Stephen Goldman, and This is The Infinite Inning. Welcome back to the show. I am very pleased to see, at least in my mind's eye, all of you here, and I would like to especially thank our many Patreon contributors who really do help make the show possible. I am grateful, of course, for every listener, so if you are not among that group, do not feel left out. I love you too. But the Patreon cats, the lads and lassies who have contributed there, give me the freedom to spend time brushing up these tales, reminding myself of details that this addled mind of mine might have let slip over the years, and getting that air of verisimilitude that helps me really tell the stories the way I want to tell them. So thank you, thank you, thank you so very much. Having said that, though, here's an awkward segue. I'd like to ask you for a favor. Well, before I do that, let me tell you that this week I am joined by Andrew Stoughton, who covers the Toronto Blue Jays for The Athletic and also hosts a podcast about the same Birds All Day. And the occasion for speaking with him was that, first of all, the Blue Jays, as a team that's been in sort of a rut for most of the last, 25, 26 years now, is fascinating to me. And the other reason, of course, is that the number one prospect in baseball, Vlad Guerrero Jr., has just been called up. Now, when I talked to Andrew, it was actually a couple of days before it happened. So we were still talking about it as if this prospect's call-up was still, well, prospective. However, everything that we discussed about why the Blue Jays were waiting, what we could anticipate from Guerrero, what it meant to the future of the team, is still 100% valid. So I don't feel like the show has dated at all, except for, as I said, we were talking about it in the future tense, and we knew that it was imminent, so we mentioned that too. Before I roll Andrew in here, let me just complete the thought or thoughts that I interrupted so that I might introduce him. That's me, a masterly master of ceremonies, always arranging my batting order in the optimal sequence. Since I began the show talking about ejections, Bryce Harper has been thrown out of 12 games. As of the most recent one last week, Harper has played 942 games. Derek Jeter played 2,407 games and was never ejected, not once. Chipper Jones was ejected 7 times in 2,499 games. How about the very salty Ty Cobb? Cobb was tossed 15 times, but in 3,034 games. None of the foregoing is to suggest that any of those gentlemen are or were better people than Bryce Harper, but merely to place his 12 ejections in context in such a young career. That is a lot of times to be asked to remove yourself from the premises, and it would probably be better for him and for his teams if he got that toned down a bit. Also, sort of related to that subject, I have a piece up at Deadspin. It's about baseball's unwritten rules and how they came about, and why sometimes human nature means that they are still necessary and will probably continue to be necessary. There's a link to that story in the Facebook group should you want to peruse it. I hope you do. It's very much an infinite inning kind of story, and I hope you enjoy it. Speaking of salty players, I come to you a bit on the salty side today myself for a few reasons, the lightest of which is that, as I alluded to in the last show, we're doing some renovations around here, which made getting time to do this here production a little bit difficult. Let me just give you a taste. I was trying to lay down one of the commercial breaks in my discussion with Mr. Stoughton, and here's how it came out, to the extent that it came out at all. couple of points about this song. I guess I'll have to change my plan, written by Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz, sung by Frank Sinatra from one of his early albums with Capitol, charts by Nelson Riddle. No matter who's doing it, and versions of the song go back to 1932, it has this wonderfully nonchalant air for someone who's just been dumped. And that's not nearly as bad as it got. I've actually dropped the volume on that quite a bit, so you don't get the full effect of it because, as I said earlier, I like you. I've had sawing, I've had drilling, I've had sledgehammers, I've had crowbars, and I don't know if you've read a lot about podcast production, but all of the authorities recommend that you do not record when people are using sledgehammers around you. Word to the wise, if you haven't figured that out yet. That's not the real reason I'm kind of ticked off right now. And that is the self-same reason that I would like to, as I said earlier, ask you for a favor. I feel a little uncomfortable discussing this, but I really don't know what else to do. I rarely talk about these kinds of things when they don't happen, and they don't happen all the time, which sounds like a contradiction in terms. But when you're a writer, it's just a fact or reality that you have to live with. So for the last year, longer really, on and off, I've been working on a book. And that book did not sell, which is fine. It's disappointing, but it's fine. Sometimes they don't. And even if the idea is good, they might not. I was kind of ambivalent about doing this one anyway, which was a baseball book. I'd like to see my name in bookstores again because I kind of enjoy that and because I like telling stories and I like writing and this is just what my life has been about. However, there is a book I do want to do even more than this book that just failed, and it's a series of stories very much in the vein of The Infinite Inning, just not restricted to baseball. So I tossed the idea past my agent and he said, and I'm paraphrasing just very slightly, you're going to be tempted to think that I'm hyperbolizing. I promise you, I am not. He said, you are a person of much too limited a stature to write about the things that you want to write about. Now, he has no idea what I want to write about because he was so insistent on rejecting me on this basis that he has yet to actually receive the idea. It's in his possession. He has not looked at it. He said, your platform is much too small. I have another writer right now whose social media standing is much greater than yours. Not Steve. I think that's a good idea, but it's not saleable. Or I think it's a bad idea, but it is saleable. Or not even, man, you're a good enough writer that you could really do that subject justice. But simply, you don't have enough Twitter followers, so flake off, buddy. Now, here's the thing. I know that social media is a key to making this show and all the things that I do successful. It is a promotional tool. I get that. That said, I cannot be who I'm not. Psychologically, social media makes me miserable because of what you are exposed to. I think you know what I mean. Second of all, though, even though I find time to spend on social media, I am not going to be an Instagram influencer given my age, tastes, and time of life. I would like my work to be on exhibition, though, and I would like to have the standing to tell more stories because stories are what my life is about, and I feel thwarted right now, corked like a bottle. So if you could do me a favor, if you like this show, or you've read my written work and you've enjoyed that, tell people. I know many of you already do. You've told me that you do. But the bigger an audience this show has, and it has a sizable one, for which I'm very grateful, the more stories I can tell. That is not about money for me. It's about my life having meaning. So if you can tweet it, or Facebook it, or Instagram it, or ask your mom to listen, as I say at the end of the show, go to iTunes and rate, review, and subscribe, or even tell a favorite publication of yours that this show should be part of its lineup or reviewed in some way. It would help me do things I want to do more than just about anything else in my life right now, which is show that agent that he was wrong. I very much hope that I have not imposed on you by asking, and I am very grateful for anything that you might do. I feel like I've said that 10 times already today and will continue to say it, how grateful I am. But as I've said before on this program, my ability to have this interaction with you is one of the best things that has ever happened to me, and I am loath to in any way strain it, even for the infinite inning revenge plot. Audience, you complete me. Speaking of the audience, last week I discussed at length the career of the recently departed pitcher of the 1980s, Scott Sanderson, and I invoked all the things that I recalled about Sanderson, his pitching style, the arc of his career, but also the fact that in 1991 he took a stand against female reporters in the clubhouse. That story provoked, and this is not something I'm salty about, this is something I appreciate, a response from one of the members of the Facebook group, Jeffrey, who wrote, "I feel compelled, after listening to this week's episode, to comment on the diatribe regarding Scott Sanderson's approach to women in the clubhouse. First off, let me state that I believe that equal access for women and men reporters in the clubhouse is clearly the right policy to have. However, what I object to was the take that Scott's feelings on women in the clubhouse is the main thing we should remember about him in death. I guess all the other things he did in life should be forgotten. Any charity work, forgotten. All the work he did for the Players Union, forgotten. Autographs signed for kids, forgotten, etc. This doesn't seem fair to me." Complicating this discussion, we don't really know why he had this objection in the first place. Was it religious belief, as is claimed in some articles during his career? Was he body shamed as a younger person? Was he a victim of sexual abuse? Was he a painfully shy person? Or was he just a misogynist? I don't think we really know the answer, so I don't think we should jump to the extreme conclusion that he was a misguided male chauvinist that should be condemned publicly now that he is deceased. It would seem to me to be a much fairer journalistic approach to mention this as part of who he was and use that as a bridge to discuss the issue more fully, not to be the one defining representation of his character now that he is no longer here to defend himself. First, thanks go to Jeffrey for taking the time to listen and respond. And let me be super clear here in that in responding to Jeffrey, I am trying to answer in an honest way and not trying to score points or win an argument. This is all friendly and it's about learning from each other. I don't know if Jeffrey heard me the way I intended to be heard, which could very well be my fault. First of all, if he didn't, I assume that I did a poor job and there are others like that. It very well may be the case that I didn't construct the story tightly enough. When you're a writer or a podcaster, your job is to make sure that your meaning is understood. You can't wholly control a reader's reaction, of course, or a listener's, and you shouldn't try. But when I'm doing something that is persuasive, basically the thing that you were taught to write back in junior high in high school, a persuasive essay, I want to make sure that the argument goes the way that I want it to go and that I've shut off avenues that would lead the reader or the listener into blind alleys or things that I didn't intend. And that's something that normally I think I'm pretty good at. If you're writing fiction, it's a little different. And you can't really control whether people get that the purple whale is a symbol. And if they do, they might think the purple whale is some kind of phallic symbol, even when that was the furthest thing from your mind. That you can't control. But if you're trying to say that day is day and not night, and somehow the reader comes away thinking that you meant night, that's a problem. Thus, this deponent hereby testifies that it was not his intention to say that Sanderson's misogyny is the main thing we should remember him for. I spent a lot of time in the segment describing him as a pitcher for exactly that reason, because he was a good one and his work brought me pleasure. I mean that honestly. Once upon a time, it did. My intention was to say that his memory file contains things other than pitching. It contains this position that he took, and it wasn't a good position then, and as society has evolved, it looks even worse now. Shakespeare's line from Julius Caesar, "The evil that men do lives after them while the good is oft interred with their bones," has been quoted so many times that it qualifies as a cliche, but it's true. And in Sanderson's case, it serves as a warning. And Jeffrey's right, it's not fair, but it's also real. It's also true. Just one stupid act can undo all the positives of an entire life. And that's why we always have to be careful about the way that we comport ourselves. And it seems to me that Jeffrey's many possible explanations for why Sanderson did what he did are of no relevance whatsoever. As we know, in life, in physics, in everything, there are causes and effects. Sanderson's intentions were the causes. If the effects were destructive or harmful to others, then I don't think the reasons for them matter, because in the end, we're responsible for how we impact other people, or anything really in our universe, in our environment. I could walk outside of my house right now, were I to own a gun, which I do not, and fire it into the air, just for the pure joy of firing a gun into the air. A young Louis Armstrong did that and wound up in a boys' home, wherein he learned how to play the cornet. So ultimately, it was a good thing. But he went out, he illegally fired a gun into the air. Well, I could do that, and maybe the bullet goes up and it comes down somewhere and no harm is done. On the other hand, maybe a bald eagle is passing by at that moment, or a rare California condor, and I shoot it through the heart, and I have destroyed something beautiful, whether I intended to or not. But even that example doesn't really work, because Sanderson knew exactly what it was he was doing, which was to interfere with female reporters doing their job. And what is a female reporter? She is just a human being trying to do a job who is being discriminated against for the shape of her genitals, or the size of her chest, or a slightly different hormone balance. We don't know Sanderson's reasons, Jeffrey said, and maybe they emerge out of some trauma of his own. But your trauma does not give you license to inflict trauma on others, which is to say that in that context, I do not give a damn if that was his reason for doing so. Now, I care very much in another sense. If someone has a problem that causes them to be out of balance with the world around them, I very much hope they get assistance for that problem, and I would like to help them get that assistance. I would like to be that assistance if I could be it, and I hope that if I am out of balance with the world, that someone will come along and be that assistance for me. But if you have a problem, your pain is not an excuse to inflict pain and inconvenience on other people, and that is what Sanderson did to whatever minimal extent, and I do assume it was minimal. Trying to deform the world around you to suit your particular hang-ups, fears, perversions is a selfish thing to do. Fix you, not the world. And ask yourself this, if we took women out of it and described some other objection that a player might have, he's uncomfortable with African-American reporters in the clubhouse, or Asian reporters, or Latino reporters, or gay reporters, whatever it is, are we really going to propose that there's some legitimate twitchiness in his background, which means that he should be allowed to take that stand or excused for doing so? No. But if it's women we're talking about, and something vaguely having to do with boy-girl stuff and the fact that certain body parts may or may not be on display, well, suddenly it's okay. I think it's because women are probably the most derogated aspect of humanity that exists. So to wrap up and to leave this topic perhaps for forever, Sanderson was a very good pitcher, at least at times. He had a long and accomplished career, and he did this one dumb thing. And my point was to say that all those things in assessing someone's life do balance against each other. Jeffrey was right that he's not here to defend himself anymore, but there is absolutely nothing to defend. It would make no difference whether he were here or not. You can't defend the indefensible. And on that note, we will pause for a break as always so you can mull that over. I welcome more responses. I appreciate and respect everything that you say. I hope you can see that or hear that as the case may be. When we reconvene on the other side, Andrew Stoughton will be here for some Toronto Blue Jays and Vlad Guerrero, the sequel discussion. I hope to see you then. And tell the country about the Infinite Inning, please. Thank you. My next guest writes about the Toronto Blue Jays for The Athletic and also podcasts about them at Birds All Day, which is now also part of The Athletic. He's Andrew Stoughton. How are you, Andrew?
I am doing well. I'm honored to be here.
Well, I really appreciate your joining me. To talk about the Blue Jays, first impressions, I think, are very hard to shake. And when I was young, and I'm not sure how old you are, but I assume you were young once also, so perhaps your lifespan overlaps with this. But I was a teenager, and I'm talking about from 1983 up through 1993, the Blue Jays organization with Pat Gillick running things was really the pride of baseball and just a fantastic, intimidating team. And I don't have to list all the players for you. You know them, Lloyd Mosby and Jesse Barfield and Dave Steeb and those guys. But since that culminated in the back-to-back World Series in 1992 and 1993, 26 years, we've had two playoff appearances, and they're not even a 500 team about half the time. There are very few key players left, even now, who went to the 2016 ALCS. So when does this team turn a corner for real?
That is the question we've been asking for, it feels like, eons now. I think it's the last couple of years, right? I mean, even though they sort of nominally were, they kept Josh Donaldson last year, turns out to have been a pretty significant mistake, and sort of tried to quote unquote go for it, though they were really, I think, being a little bit half pregnant because, you know, bringing in a Curtis Granderson is not a go for it move. They were very, you know, cautious to not trade away any prospects or anybody that they really valued. They've been building the minor league system and sort of letting it reaccumulate talent after all those guys were dealt away in 2015 by Alex Anthopoulos. None of whom, or most of whom, really haven't made an impact in the big leagues at all. I think Matt Boyd is maybe the lone exception there. And so, yeah, we've been waiting for that for a really long time, even though the Jays only within the last, 10 months or so have been willing to say that they're in a rebuild. It's been going on in a lot of ways, in a lot of clear ways, for a while now. And so, yeah, but I don't know. I don't know when it's going to, when the corner is going to turn, because we haven't seen the talent here yet. You know, we're still waiting for Guerrero, who is hopefully imminent. It seems like that, nonsense, that whole saga is about to be over. But yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of like green shoots throughout the organization, and some really good arms still coming, and some impressive talent in the minor leagues. But it's certainly not going to be 2019, and probably not 2020 either.
You know what's been interesting to me? I don't know if this is a dumb question, but talking to Blue Jays fans over the years, a lot of the time it's hard for many of us to have loyalty to a team that has been in the doldrums for as long as they were prior to the two playoff appearances in 2015 and 2016. But I felt like the fans I talked to had substituted for winning by getting really attached to guys like Donaldson and Troy Tulowitzki. So I'm wondering if now that they're gone, you sense that there's kind of a recalibration in Blue Jays fandom, and they're basically everything is just waiting for Guerrero now.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know that it's necessarily just that the personalities are gone, but it was a special kind of magic in 2015 that came back, and that, you mentioned off the top there about, the team that they were in the late 80s, early 90s. And, they were the first team, I think, to sell 4 million tickets when they moved into the Sky Dome. And it was the place to be, and the Leafs were bad for most of that period. And so like the Blue Jays were just like a huge, huge franchise, a huge like icon of sports in this part of the world. That you just, it's hard to believe if you didn't live through it, I think, at this point, because it's been so bad since then. And part of the trouble has been, I mean, it was just a disaster, what happened with, the team getting bad and the strike happening all at the same time. And, they made a lot of mistakes in terms of, I think they didn't stagger how their luxury boxes were, like the contracts. So, you know, 10 years after the Dome opened in 1989, so in 1999, they just lost a ton of revenue there. And they were owned by Labatt's, which was, you know, a Canadian company, really had sort of local investment. And then it got gobbled up by conglomerates who, you know, didn't really care. And now they're owned by Rogers, which for American listeners is basically one of two telecom companies in Canada. You either get your cable and your internet through Rogers or through Bell. Half of the country gets a bill from the team, the people that own the Blue Jays every week, and just hates them, right? I mean, and so it's really hard to form that kind of attachment with a team like that, especially when you see the way that the boardroom decisions filter down to the way that the team is operated. You know, we look at it here in Canada, we're like, they're on nationally on Sportsnet, a network owned by Rogers. And that's another thing that irks people, right? Because the relationship between the team, you know, the Blue Jays and their ownership is murky. And so nobody knows whether they're, you know, you hear all the billion-dollar TV contracts teams had been signing for such a long time. You know, nobody knows what the equation is between like what the Jays get from Rogers for their content being on Rogers' TV property. And yet we know that, you know, millions of people were watching the playoff games that they were in a couple of years ago, 15, 16, you know, there was like 6 million people watching, or 8 million, or numbers that are staggering. And that, you know, in the hockey world, you see, you know, we kind of try to compare it against that and look at, you know, what Rogers values those TV rights as, because there's, you know, a competitive, you know, other people are bidding for the rights, other organizations, notably Bell, because there's really only two here in Canada. We're such a strange country in a lot of ways. But yeah, so you see just the decisions that they make, even though they have such a huge market, they're on in Vancouver, they're on in Montreal. Toronto is such a big, wealthy city as well. You know, I don't know that a lot of Americans know this, but it's like, you know, it's like Chicago sized or you know, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's a real big city, and there's no excuse that the Blue Jays should ever be financial, you know, playing so far behind, we think, the Yankees and the Red Sox. But that's just been the case forever, and there have been all sorts of, it's like, esoteric reasons for it that go back to the boardroom at Rogers and how that relationship works, because it's just they're not as invested in the team as they're invested in a team as a money making product. I guess everybody is to an extent, but there's just never that real incentive to try to push too hard. Or there's weird filters through which they look at the team that is not like a fan. And we kind of, you know, look at, you know, and I think this is kind of going away anyway, but we looked at, you know, down the road in Detroit at Mike Ilitch or at benevolent owners who are, you know, really willing to go the extra mile and say, oh, you know, winning ball games, that's what's going to make our product the most valuable. And that's our strategy. The Jays for a long time did not operate like that. And it's just, it alienated a lot of people. And when those trades happened in 2015, and when it looked like, you know, here are the Blue Jays again, people just embraced it so much because they'd missed it, and it hasn't been a part of the culture here, of the sports conversation here, for such a long time. It's just always been a real drag. That's where we're at. I think that's the thing about that, though, is that, you know, the new guys came in and right away saw that and saw that, you know, the only way that they're going to do anything here is just to win ball games. And I think they've been not had a great time in terms of their image in town. I don't think they're particularly well liked, but I think they at least know enough not to care too much, and know that as long as they eventually do turn that corner and eventually do put a team that, you know, on the field that has the opportunity to play in the playoffs, people are going to come back for that, because it was intoxicating just to have it for, you know, a couple of years. It really reminded people why sports is good. And I don't know if you know about the history of the Leafs also, but or the Raptors. There's been a little few and far between the good times in Toronto sports.
Toronto is a city of almost 3 million. The metropolitan area is about 6 million. And I guess that would put it about in the top half of major league markets just based on population. I don't know how many TV sets, but I assume that there's a similar number of TV sets there. And it never occurred to me, you know, when you have a war, say, between a cable carrier and your team's network, like down here in the New York area, the Yankees are carried on YES, and periodically there will be an argument between them the YES Network and one of the cable providers about how much they are going to charge the cable provider per customer. And so you read about them maybe blacking out the YES Network because the YES Network wants $2 more per subscriber to that cable service. And as a baseball fan, it's all secondhand. You're not paying the money directly to the Yankees or directly to Yankees ownership, even if it ultimately goes there. So it's very easy to be sympathetic and say, like, well, that's a lot cheaper than me going to the ballgame. So, yeah, give them the $2. I'll pay $2 per game to watch the Yankees or whatever the thing being negotiated is. But in your case, the Blue Jays might go to Florida for an interleague series, get swept by the Marlins, and then you get a bill you have to pay if you want to see the next episode of Game of Thrones.
A little bit, yeah. And Rogers has used the Jays to leverage, you know, getting costs onto other cable providers, because Rogers itself is a cable provider. And so they have, I think, 5 channels right now. There was a time when they introduced a new one and then put a few Blue Jays games on it that other providers were not carrying in order to sort of bribe them into, you know, make their customers demand that they carry this new Rogers channel. It's all an ugly little game that they play that the Blue Jays are caught in. But when things are good, they're very good here. I don't want to be too down on it. It's just not often enough.
Everybody is talking about the Vlad Guerrero Jr. saga. Keith Law, I heard say on ESPN today that in his estimation, Guerrero was probably ready last June, which means, and I realize they don't play baseball every month during this period, but if he shows up, let's say on May 1st, that's 11 months that they delayed his arrival, at least in real time, that we had to wait for that. In baseball terms, it's a little bit shorter. As you said, this team does well. It draws really, really well. $3 million, $4 million. And you would think that that would express itself in for Rogers in the TV ratings as well. So to manipulate this kid over service time when you don't have a Jose Bautista anymore, you don't have a Donaldson for people to watch and bring them into the park. And you can see that they're down 5,000 per game so far this year. So it seems like it was penny wise and pound foolish. I realize he was injured at the end of spring training, but since then, not to get this going already.
Yeah, it really does. And that, you know, I think it's a bit of a pattern, unfortunately, for the front office here. They've been like too cute by half a lot of times on a lot of the things they're doing, like the Donaldson, you know, like keeping him and hoping that they can maybe trade him at the trade deadline. Because, you know, obviously that didn't work out for them. And I think they you know, probably if they could do it over again, would have traded him the winter previous to last year. But yeah, no, I don't quite understand all of that, especially as you see, you know, all the extensions that these guys are signing, like why they can't have figured out a way to get him to sign. I mean, obviously Guerrero has to want to do it. Maybe the fact that his dad made $125 million in his big league career means it's not the same kind of life-changing money that, you know, an Albies or an Acuna would be looking at. But it's a strange situation, and I don't entirely understand why they've been so adamant about it. And I think I listened to Keith on that podcast as well on Baseball Today, and you know, he said it's like they're almost conceding that they're not going to be able to re-sign him at the end of his 6 years or now 7 years of obligation. And that's as you know, people in Toronto, as fans in Toronto, look at that and are like, you know, why not? Why are you consistently acting like a small market team when you're not a small market team? When MLB specifically pulled you out of the revenue sharing pool because when they based it on market size as opposed to, you know, stated revenue. And there's not really a great answer for that. I don't know. It's I think Blue Jays fans are just trying to, I think they're getting their last jokes and their last bits of anger in before they, you know, can hopefully forget about it and just watch Vlad hit dingers the rest of the summer.
Well, the other comparison is with, say, the Mets or the Padres, who brought up Peter Alonso or Fernando Tatis Jr. right at the start. And they're really reaping the rewards for that. And obviously the Blue Jays couldn't have known that the Red Sox would get off to a slow start and the Yankees would have every injury in the medical catalog. But it seems like if Guerrero was playing third, again, we can't know what start he's going to get off to once he gets to the major leagues, but he has handled literally everything that's been thrown at him, both literally and figuratively, in terms of the pitches that he's destroyed. So if Brandon Drury was on the bench rather than playing third base and hitting 190, you might think, I mean, this seems like a small thing, but if you prorated over the season, going 12-11 instead of 11-12 is a big deal.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. I mean, I don't think they think that they're going to be there in the end. I don't know that they necessarily want to, because I think there's, you know, guys like Strowman and Sanchez, and they'd hoped they could turn Matt Shoemaker into something, which, you know, unfortunately is not going to happen, but looked like, you know, he was pitching very, very well before that the unfortunate injury over the weekend. I think that's still sort of the mode that they're in. They're still in acquisition mode and still, you know, not really considering even playing for that second wild card spot, because it's just, I mean, it seems so tough to get through the real elite teams of the American League. But that's, I mean, you said that if I had said that in the winter, it would have been like, okay, sure, that makes sense. And then see how the first month of the season has played out. It's like, oh man, yeah, maybe trying to win is actually a good idea for both those reasons and the reasons that, you know, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be nobody in the building on Tuesday. Kevin Pillar is coming back, and he is, you know, not a star by any sense, but just a really a beloved role player from those teams, and the guy who was out there making all those Superman catches and then scuffling at the plate consistently, but everybody was sort of willing to overlook that. And as a guy who, you know, when he was traded, it was an emotional thing for the fan base, and it's you know, a huge part of the reason nobody's going to be there is because of the Maple Leafs playing in Game 7. But also, I think it's just, it speaks to, you know, where the team is at and where they're at in the city in terms of just being on people's radar. It's just they've been given an excuse to not care for a couple of years because they think that that's, you know, the rebuild's underway, and then there's not going to be any entertaining baseball or any reason to go and pay their money to the Blue Jays for the next couple of years. And I think that's not true, and I think that's something that the front office has overlooked a bit, because, you know, going out and watching Vlad and watching some of these young guys come up is going to be fun. And had they kept Josh Donaldson, they could have hung on to him and given him a qualifying offer, and who knows whether he would have signed it or not. It wouldn't have been that different than what he ended up with the Braves, and he did that without the draft pick tied to him. So that right there would have infused the season with a little more excitement if they'd had a Josh Donaldson and a Guerrero on the team right now. You might be even feeling pretty good about it, and that was not an unrealistic scenario at all for them. So they've just very clearly gone in a different way and want to do it their way with their guys, and they've given people the excuse to stay away, and people have taken that excuse, it seems.
Well, in fairness to them, Donaldson is a guy who has been consistently underestimated in his career. I think that's kind of a theme. He was traded away from the Cubs, and the A's seemed to think of him as kind of a backup catcher for a while before he broke through at third base. And then given the injuries of the last couple of years, it was tempting, given his age, to think like, well, maybe he just slowed down a little bit earlier. We're not used to thinking of him as being the age that he is because he got such a late start. Mm-hmm. So at least for me, it would be dishonest to second guess them about that. But it sounds like up there, you guys might have had some first guesses about it.
Yeah, it was more of a fan thing, I think. I think the front office was pretty clearly going to trade him and going to not let the qualifying offer be a question, because I don't know if they would have given him the offer, frankly. Because also part of it is that I think they were just kind of done with him. There was, you know, it came out a little bit after the season that there'd been some disagreements about injury treatment, and I think at one point the training staff had changed, and you know, when the new regime came in, and he's gone to the Braves, where Alex Anthopoulos is the previous GM here, and had brought in the head trainer George Poulos, was previously the Blue Jays trainer. He's now with the Braves, and I think that, you know, who knows what Donaldson's market was this winter, but that supposedly factored into that decision a little bit, because it was somebody who he'd worked with, who, you know, Donaldson has had, you know, calf problems and similar problems for a few years and managed to play through it. And it was just 2018 that he was really sidelined by them. And I think he felt that the previous training staff had done a better job. And that was, you know, the cause of some acrimony between him and the Blue Jays last year. And I think for those reasons and maybe others, they were kind of just like, you know, we're turning a page. We're, you know, next year it's going to be, you know, the foundation of guys who we want to be here long term, your Danny Jansons, your eventually Guerreros, eventually Bichette, and really, I think, making a concerted effort to make the clubhouse theirs a little bit. But fans did at the time, especially the fans did not really appreciate that view when it looked like, you know, you're just kind of giving Josh Donaldson away for nothing when you could have him back for the price of a qualifying offer here. And as you say, yeah, I think that there was definitely part of the assessment is the fact that he has been hurt. I mean, we can't obviously judge we can't say that he's going to keep performing the way he has the last few weeks for the whole season too. I mean, he's it's entirely possible that something befalls him as well, which would be a shame. He's an incredibly fun player to watch. Blue Jays fans know that better than anybody. It was a great run that he had here, but they've very very deliberately, I think, gone this young direction. It's a little hard to get super excited about it here in its like early days before the real talent starts to show up.
You mentioned Pilar coming back. It must at least be a bit of a relief that he calmed down a little bit, because a few days after being traded to the Giants, he hit 4 home runs in the space of about 6 days. And I thought, it can't be that the Giants fixed Kevin Pilar where the Blue Jays failed for all those years. That's not fair at all.
Well, I mean, the Blue Jays fixed Kevin Pillar every April, and then it would be May till September where he went back to being the regular old Kevin Pillar. So I don't think people were too worried about that, actually, because we've seen that movie before.
I guess I'll have to change my plan. I should have realized there'd be another man. I overlooked that point completely. Until the big affair began, before I knew where I was at, I found myself upon the shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air.
This classic old song about being dumped once had a very different sentiment attached to it. Arthur Schwartz, the composer, went to summer camp as a counselor with Larry Hart, the great lyricist, and Larry put a lyric to it that went, "I love to lie awake in bed." Try it, it parses, but for whatever reason, that song had no further life beyond summer camp, and eventually Howard Dietz put a new lyric to it, "I guess I'll have to change my plans." I love some of his ideas here too, like the blue pajamas. What do those have to do with anything?
Why did I buy those blue pajamas before that big affair began?
I guess blue pajamas are a sign of overcommitment or committing to domesticity. I'm not really sure. In any case, we'll take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more conversation with Andrew Stoughton and a bit less Frank Sinatra and Nelson Riddle. See you then.
Personal hell, I'll have to change my plan.
So Baseball Prospectus's projection for Guerrero, a .311 batting average with a .528 slugging percentage in the major leagues. This is the median projection. If he gets 450 major league at-bats, they project he'll hit about 25 doubles and 20 home runs. Dan Szymborski over at Fangraphs is in the same ballpark. Does that sound about right to you?
I think that sounds right, yeah. Yeah, which will make him by far the Blue Jays' best hitter, I'm pretty sure, as well. Just sitting there in Buffalo right now, riding the bus in Syracuse somewhere as we speak. It's absurd.
How has he handled it? He can see what he achieves on a given night. And of course, he knows that what his dad did. So he must understand the business to a certain extent. Do you think that this will affect his future relationship with the Jays?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, from outwardly, he has really handled it exceptionally well. I mean, there was Ross Atkins said earlier in the spring, like, I just don't see an MLB player there when he was, you know, before he was given the reprieve of Vlad's injury. And we're still thinking about, oh, we're going to have to manipulate his service time and create excuses to not have him in the big leagues. And I'm sure he saw a thing like that, but has been, you know, consistent when he does do media interviews. He doesn't, I don't think he does anything in English. I don't know how good his English is, but he definitely isn't out there answering questions day in, day out in English, I don't believe. But when he has spoken, it's been, you know, he's held to the idea that, you know, he understands it's a business, that his time is going to come. He's not really bothered by any of that. And that he'll get his chance when he gets his chance. And it doesn't necessarily mean that he believes that behind closed doors. And it would be hard not to be a little bit frustrated, I think, with the way that he's been handled. But like you say, like with his dad having been in the business and under, you know, in his ear, probably about, you know, this is how this stuff works. I don't know that it's that big of a concern. And yeah, that's become a bit of a narrative. And even in the last couple of days, I know Keith talked about it on that Baseball Today as well, and about how, you know, what it's going to do to the relationship and whether it's something that is going to prevent the Blue Jays from being able to extend him at some point or what it's going to mean. I don't know that that's too much of a concern, just because it's, you know, money talks. I think, you know, that's my personal view of it. And a lot of these guys, I mean, people will point out Chris Bryant, but I think there's a lot of examples where guys will sign what's in front of them if it makes financial sense for them. And the other thing is that, like I said before, they seem to be playing it as though he's not going to re-sign with them anyway at the end of his 6/7 years. So maybe that's a moot point. I don't know. But I tweeted this earlier today as well. It's like, I mean, if Shapiro and Atkins are still here in 7 years, then things will have gone pretty well. And so there should be some pretty good incentive for him to take their money and for them to want to keep paying him to stick around. So hopefully, you know, if you're a Blue Jays fan, that's how you kind of hope that all works out. But in the meantime, I don't know. I think everybody's just ready to put it all behind them and just embrace Vlad as a big league player as he has, you know, as he should have been for the last, you know, almost whole year, probably, like you said.
You know, the one thing that makes me paranoid about him, and of course about Dante Bichette's kid, who unfortunately just broke his hand, so
yeah,
we don't know when he's going to get a chance to come up and play shortstop for the Blue Jays, is that, and maybe this is just me, but I feel like we could call this the curse of Cito Gaston for the hostility that he seemed to show to young players like John Olerud and Sean Green back in the day, in that the Blue Jays, I think, their farm system's not always been great, but there's a really long track record of guys coming up and just kind of dying. And just talking about the current team, Danny Jansen's up, and this is a small sample. I know this is totally unfair that he's hitting 179, right, but I'm going to mention that he's hitting 179. And then there maybe it's not their fault that Devin Travis like breaks every time the wind blows, or that Anthony Alford, all his talent, which seemed immense at one point, disappeared, or that Dalton Pompey didn't hit and then had concussion problems. But I feel like if I look back for more examples, going back over 10 or 15 years in different administrations of the team, they have a really hard time getting guys to make that last jump from AAA to the majors.
They really have. They really have. I think for a long time, you know, their farm team was in Vegas because they fucked that up real good for a while. I mean, it's perfect now that it's in Buffalo. I mean, that's an hour down the road, and it's a cute little ballpark and a great situation for them. But for a bunch of years, they were in Vegas, and it was just like playing on the moon. And not only that, but you know, just so you know, a few hours flight away. Which was really difficult for them. And also just because of the conditions, it was, you know, such a hitter-friendly park, and you had to contend with all that sort of stuff. And so you'd see video game numbers from David Cooper, who would come up and just be, you know, out of baseball within a couple of years, kind of a thing. But yeah, no, I mean, it's absurd. It's I could cite like Aaron Hill and Adam Lind were sort of the previous generations, like only drafted and developed big league hitters out of the Blue Jays, which are not not guys that are super memorable maybe anywhere but in Toronto. But you know, yeah, you have to go back to like Vernon Wells, Alex Rios, and before that Carlos Delgado. Like it's been there's not a great track record, as you say. I don't know if that's organizational. Obviously, through the 80s and early 90s, they did an outstanding job with stuff like that. And it got away from them under multiple regimes, like you say. And I don't know what it is. I honestly don't know what it is. I think that we can go through the whole history of it. I know that, you know, they were with JP Ricciardi, that was sort of early 2000s. They adopted the Moneyball thing, like right when everybody else did. And I think there's stories of, you know, all the guys on their draft board being gone by the fourth round because every team was identifying the same guys to pick, which really sort of set them back. And they really focused a lot on pitching, I think, in the Anthopoulos era. And I think it was kind of the idea of drafting arms to eventually trade them, or just drafting arms because they're so hard to acquire. And so, yeah, it's been a real desert. And I think another thing has been under Anthopoulos, they were very focused on toolsy guys and you know, the Anthony Gosses of the world and the Alfords and guys who had big, loud tools, except for the hit tool, maybe. So, which is kind of an important one if you're going to maybe put use to any of the others, right? So, I don't know that there's just one thing, and because it's gone on for so long, I I hope it's not just a curse, but yeah, it's been discouraging. But like you say, with Bichette and with Guerrero coming and Kevin Biggio, another son of an incredible big leaguer, is looking very good in Buffalo and has sort of had a breakout since he started putting the ball in the air more last year or the year before. It looks like that's hopefully going to turn around for them, but who knows yet? I think we all feel pretty confident about Vlad, but even beyond him, the jury's still a bit out.
Because of that, I wondered if that was the rationale for the Randall Grichuk extension, in that Grichuk, I mean, first of all, they're playing poor with Guerrero, and then suddenly they dig up the nickels to extend this guy through 2023, and nothing against him. I mean, he has some real power ability. He can play at least a decent center field. I mean, I don't think he's Tris Speaker out there, but he's decent. And at the same time, he hasn't, for his career anyway, posted a 300 on base percentage in the major leagues. And given his approach, that's going to be a struggle every year. So I felt like it was an odd decision, unless they were like, look, he's breathing. He's got all his limbs. His liver seems okay. Like, let's lock this dude up.
Well, I think with Pilar on the way out, which, you know, obviously he was, and I think that, you know, rightly so. I mean, that was probably done, and he was a couple years from free agency, or a year and a half from free agency. So that made sense. And with, you know, Alfred and Pompey have had opportunities, and they just haven't stayed healthy. And Grichuk is a guy who looks like he's been durable. I mean, he was on the disabled list a little bit last year, but which is actually when he kind of changed his batting stance, and which seemed to really unlock some power for him. But not just power, but he had a great stretch from, you know, June 1st onward last year. It was terrible in April. And yeah, I don't know. You're right. He's an odd guy to have extended. It's not like crazy money. And this is a team that has, you know, lots of flexibility going forward. They have hardly any money on the books other than, you know, what they're paying Troy Tulowitzki the next couple of years. So I think that made some sense there. But yeah, he's a guy that, like exactly you say, is going to struggle to get on base. It's just the high strikeout approach and not a lot of walks and a bit streaky. And it's been interesting, actually, because the Jays have collected a few guys kind of like that. I know Teoscar Hernandez fits that profile as well. I don't know if they think they're getting one over on somebody by trying to pick up a bunch of guys that are like that. But it can make the lineup quite dreadful to watch at times when, like, all of them are not going right, which was basically the case for most of this month.
Justin Smoke is the big example there. He's evolved into a guy who has a pretty good selective approach at the plate, and you'd think at this point he's kind of the veteran guy on the team, the dean of it, maybe. You'd think it might rub off a little bit, but not so much.
No, not so much, not yet. Yeah, Smoke is a really interesting guy, actually. I mean, you feel, you know, people here really like him, just as a dude, and like, you just feel good about the career that he's managed to have, like, as a busted prospect who sort of figured it out late and has just turned into a really nice hitter. He was just awful for 2,000, 3,000 plate appearances there, and then the last 2,000 or so, just been a real nice hitter. It's not the career anybody foresaw for him, I don't think. But yeah, he's been really valuable for the Jays, and is definitely, I think, at this point, the dean, especially after Kendrys Morales getting traded to the A's there, right on the cusp of the season.
First round draft pick, 11th overall. And then, yeah, just didn't work it out for the longest time, where he was a switch hitter in name only. He was decent from one side of the plate. And again, small sample stuff, but off to just a terrific start this year with a 176 OPS plus.
Yeah, I can't say enough good things about him. I mean, I could probably, at some point, I could stop saying good things about him. And everybody really loves the glove work, too, actually. First base defense being what it is, you know, nobody's paying for it. Infielders will say they love throwing to him. He's making them look good. That equates to elite first base defense, I guess. I don't know.
So tell me a little bit about yourself and the hero's journey to covering the Blue Jays for The Athletic.
That's an odd story, or maybe a typical one these days with the people who, you know, are doing stuff like that. But, you know, I just years and years ago, 10, 12 years ago, started a blog. Thought my buddies and I thought we could write better than the hacks at the local papers, and just did it as a laugh, and ended up, you know, people started reading it and got asked to start doing a podcast for a TV network in Canada here called The Score, which is now, the TV side's been absorbed by Rogers, but you still see The Score as an app. You can get all your fancy scores on it and stuff. I don't want to advertise for them because they shit canned me there a few years ago, but yeah, and just, you know, it's sort of, you know, gone on from there. That site ended up was called Drunk Jays Fans. If anybody remembers it, I thoroughly apologize for my conduct over the years. And yeah, it sort of just morphed into this thing. And after Drew Ferris Service and I got let go by The Score, we had, you know, we were doing podcasts there. We were doing a Drunk Jays Fans podcast and one called Getting Blanked. He ran the MLB, the all-encompassing MLB vertical there. And we just decided to continue on doing it, backed by Patreon. And there were enough people supporting us doing that, giving us their hard-earned money for a while to allow us to, you know, not have to get real jobs, or allow me to not have to get a real job. And so that's wound its way into here I am covering the Jays for The Athletic, and they've just brought our podcast in-house as well, which has been a fun little wrinkle that I don't think him or I saw coming, but happy to be on board as they sort of start to explore that realm as well.
Well, given that career path, I'm curious if you've had this experience that I've had in different ways. And my guest last week, actually, Bill Baer of Hardball Talk, he started out also blogging about the Phillies at Crash Burn Alley. Yeah, and he talked here about kind of having to professionalize himself, because when he started, he was about 19. He said whatever he wanted without a lot of regard for the consequences. And then eventually he makes his way to NBC, and he said that there hasn't been any pressure on him to change. And yet at the same time, you do, as you mature, learn to adhere to certain standards, maybe just out of self-preservation, but also hopefully you do grow and learn. I never wrote my own private blog, but I started in the same way that you did and he did, by blogging for MLB.com and the Yes Network about the Yankees. And the process that I went through was that for a long time, the upstairs people didn't quite notice that I was there. And so I could say what I wanted to say and have a really great readership, but they weren't focused on that. They were focused on TV stuff. And then suddenly they started to pay attention. And then it was, you can't badmouth that trade. That's our trade. Or that's George Steinbrenner, or one of the Steinbrenners is going to be very upset that you said that this trade was a bad trade. And so I'm wondering if, as you went and The Score got absorbed by Rogers, who eventually end up owning the Blue Jays and so on, I'm not sure if the chronology all knits there, but if you also found, especially starting from the perspective of drunken Blue Jays fan, that you did find yourself toning it down over time and changing your approach.
I mean, I definitely have toned it down, but I chalk that more up to personal growth than any of that stuff. I mean, the chronology, I've never worked for Rogers when they owned I've never worked for Rogers, period. I think they owned a small stake in The Score for a time when I was there, but when they absorbed the TV network, I ended up going off into the company that is the current internet, a web-only iteration of it. So I've never been an employee of Rogers or anybody connected with the Jays. So I've never had those same sort of concerns about, oh, is somebody going to worry about what I'm going to say about this trade, or is somebody of consequence to my own career going to worry about what I'm going to say about this trade? So that's been fortunate. I think I like pointing that out because I think a lot of people don't think that's true, because I can often be really pro, not pro ownership. I mean, I think a lot of people who came out of, you know, the sabermetric kind of stuff, or who'd been reading Fire Joe Morgan and those early blogs, just trying to make sense of the world of baseball through the lens of, you know, just actually how the industry thinks and operates, and not as a fan. And I think that that's kind of led, when it sort of doesn't jibe with what the fans want or think, to it's like, oh, you're just being a shill for ownership or for the management. It's like, well, I'm actually just trying to understand what the hell they're thinking here too. But, you know, that's just sort of the nature of the beast, I think, of writing about a team and writing about something that people just get so passionate about. But yeah, no, it's definitely changed over the years. I know there are definitely people who read me who miss the old days of just being more, you know, incendiary with my comments and less, not filtered, I would say, because I don't feel I'm filtered now. It's just I would be less concerned about shooting my dumb mouth off about something. But yeah, I don't know how much that is necessarily just fear for my, you know, I want to keep my job. Obviously, it's pretty great to be doing what I do. But really, they, you know, that's when I came to the Athletic. I did some freelance stuff for them for a year, and then I've been full time since a year ago, and they've been awesome. And they've also just right from the hop said, you know, we don't want to neuter you. We want you to be here to be you. Obviously, they want me to bring my audience to them, and for the audience to get what they want out of me. So I'm sure I could be wilder and crazier. But it's also that I did that for a long time and was like sort of the angry Blue Jays fan, or, you know, it's fun to just sort of not even performatively, but just sort of to take a kernel of outrage and turn it into a full blown rant about something. It's just, and it becomes a shtick a bit, and you just get tired of it as a person. It's like, I don't know if there was like a day I made a conscious decision to be like, okay, let's be a little more centered and focused on really, you know, analyzing things and stop just making jokes and calling people dickheads. but it just eventually sort of came about, I guess. And I'm much happier for it. I don't know that my readers necessarily are, but yeah, I don't know. It's been a strange trip. And I guess, you know, just a journey of personal discovery. That's how I like to think about it.
Boldly going where no Blue Jays fan has gone before.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song, the things we did last summer. The Midway and the fun, the Cupid dolls we won, the bell you rang to prove that you were strong, the things we did last summer.
You're listening to Joe Stafford sing one of her minor hits, The Things We Did Last Summer. In his book, A Biographical Guide to the Great Jazz and Pop Singers, the critic Will Friedwald wrote, "When all is said and done, who was Joe Stafford? A pop singer and a comic, a ballad singer and a folk singer, a band singer and a group singer, a swinger and a mourner, not to mention a radio and TV star, wife and mother. She's a riddle to be solved, with no simple answers, and she haunts you so that after hearing her just once, you can't ever unhear her." That's very insightful because, as you can hear, she had a truly honeyed voice. And between 1944, when she went solo, and 1953, I count 32 top 10 hits for Joe Stafford, either alone or as part of a duet, and 4 number ones. And yet, I don't think anyone knows who she is today. Whenever you meet someone who thinks they're on top of the world, that they've really established themselves in some way, remind them of old Joe Stafford. We'll take a quick break, and then I'll be back to wrap my conversation with Andrew Stoughton. See you on the other side.
So right, go wrong. The things we did last summer.
Though I think that a couple of things that you said are intertwined, because as a writer or a podcaster for that matter, you never want to give up your honesty or the edge that gives you your insight, right? At the same time, absolutely, you may have standards that, whether it's you who adopts those standards or the people that you work for, you want to adhere to those standards without sacrificing that. As I think we get older, and as this becomes your job rather than your hobby, you gain a little distance from it. You meet people in the industry, and instead of being faceless people who made that dumbass trade, now they're flawed human beings. If yeah, you have a little empathy, and it's harder to call them names. There's some freaking intelligent people in front offices. And yeah, they screw up because they don't have perfect foresight, but they're not all idiots, and we weren't always smarter. And so you're right that the sabermetric side of it kind of had that chip on its shoulder when it began. I feel like we've lost some of that as we become more mainstream. So there's that also. And I think a third part of it is, and this also has to do with age,
that if you start out, and I did, I was still in my 20s when I started, your off the field life or your non-job life is less developed at that point. You're not that far out of college or whatever it was that you did beforehand. Maybe you don't have kids. Maybe you don't have a family. Maybe you're not married. And as those things come along, sort of the work and the life stuff starts to balance. And that fury that the team lost that game because they didn't use the closer in a tie game on the road, it's just a little bit less.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. To go a step further, I don't write when I'm drunk and high anymore. Because that's not very professional. I don't think my employers would like that. But when I didn't have, you know, when I started doing it as a hobby, you know, you could just do whatever you want, say whatever you want, which is what endeared people, you know, to it. But I think, like, you know, not to buzzword my way through it, but you know, I think that there's an authenticity that people pick up on, and I think that I've at least hoped to, you know, hopefully have tried to keep that as well. Like I say, not wanting to just play a character for the last 10 years, but just, you know, speak my mind about that stuff. And it's just, that's not who I am anymore. And I think that probably a lot of people have a similar story, maybe not that exact story, but I think you're bang on about how that has evolved.
Well, I mean, it worked for Hunter S. Thompson for a long time until it didn't, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you could do Fear and Loathing in Toronto if you wanted to, but there must be a personal cost to that after a certain point.
And he became a victim of his own image, I think, too, right? I mean, I don't want to put myself in a category like that, but I don't know. And it's something I more think about in hindsight, and just am glad that I'm not ranting and raving about anything, because I see people who imitate the style that I wrote in a bunch of years ago, which I kind of, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, I keep trying to tell myself, which is hard to believe sometimes, but as long as they're not successful at it, I don't mind nearly as much. If they're making a lot of money trying to sound like me, that's a different thing. Or just other guys, you know, other media people who, that's their persona. I'm thinking of one in particular who I don't feel like naming, but who it's just like, oh, it's all about a rant. It's all about really hamming it up and doing things like that. And I look back and I'm like, oh, thank you. God, I'm not doing that kind of stuff anymore.
When I started my first pay for publication job, when I was a real writer who could earn money to do this, was actually not baseball, but movie reviews. And when I think back over the excesses of my youth and things that I regret or that I'm glad have since been bleached from the universe, I reviewed a movie that is now, if you see lists of like 100 greatest noir films or whatever, it's on there. And I compared one of the lead actresses, who's actually very good in it, to a chipmunk, which is not something that I would ever do today. That happens when you learn in public. And this is not one that I wrote, but I think about it often. The year before, the edition before I became the editor of the Baseball Prospectus annuals, someone, I remember who, I'm not going to say who, compared Willie Bloomquist to having a case of syphilis. I regretted that as soon as I saw it.
Yeah.
And again, I think you can be funny or insightful or say that Willie Bloomquist was a player of limited use and application without comparing him to venereal disease. So I wonder, having listened to what you just said, if there's anything you recall that you would like to have back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but like 6 years worth, I think. No, I don't know. Well, and that's part of the what was the charm and the selling point of it at first, was that it was audacious and just so different kind of writing. You know, that was part of the selling point as a writer, and I think also as readers, it was like the only way to read about the teams that you were so invested in was through the boring old newspaper, basically. And there were, you know, there were a few internet sites, but you know, the whole team specific blogging really hit a niche that was unexplored. And yeah, there are a few, and there, I guess there always have been, the old guys, you know, doing it real seriously. But I think what sort of caught on among the young people in that era was, yeah, just being completely outlandish. And I was going to say I regret all of it. I regret a lot of it, but I think it was, you know, it was important for me to get that out and grow beyond that. But yeah, no, there are lots of things I don't want to say them, but I could think specifically of things. I'm like, yeah, I shouldn't have wrote that, or shouldn't have told my co-blogger that was a good idea.
Have you since been credentialed and found yourself standing next to someone that you had criticized? I've had that experience.
Yeah, most people I used to criticize back in the day have I've stood next to, and most have been outstanding. The high point is Richard Griffin, who used to be at the Toronto Star and is now actually the PR man for the Blue Jays, just got hired over the winter, which is a trip. I haven't dealt with him too much yet this season because I live out of town. I'm not in the press box every day, but I've definitely dealt with him since then. And I had this picture that I found. I don't even know how. But it was just like an old rummy on a park bench in like Czechoslovakia or something like that. But he looked exactly like Richard Griffin. And so every time I would write something like criticizing his article, I would like use that picture as though it's Griffin. And but he, the incredible fellow that he is, like he made that his Twitter avatar for a very long time and really embraced the criticism. And then like, it's like, yeah, I came home, my son had that as the background on his computer. I've met him, and it's all a joke to him. I'm sure there's some out there who still don't look at me too fondly. I know there are radio stations in Toronto where I am not very welcome at this point, but still, despite being reasonably professional about this for the last few years. But yeah, for the most part, the real early days ones, I think those guys kind of got it and have a sense of humor about it. It's the Twitter beefs that are like current where I'm like, oh yeah, there's that guy.
You know, most of them are great and over the years have been very friendly to me. And then I've had one fairly famous New York beat writer, when I was introduced to him in the dugout, refused to shake my hand, not because I'd ever said anything bad about him, but because I was primarily an internet guy.
Right.
And I don't know if he felt threatened or what, but
There is one actually that still doesn't like me, I know, who's more like a tourist, a general columnist in the sports pages of the Sun, is Steve Simmons. I don't mind saying his name. I won't necessarily say my opinion about him, but I've written it many a times. I used to do a piece on drunk Jays fans that I brought to my own site after the score got rid of me, and I've not really done it since being at The Athletic, because I don't know that it's appropriate there. But it was called Dumbing Down the Discourse. And it would just be, here's someone who is just giving red meat to like the dumbest fans. And he would feature there more often than most. And so I bought a Toronto Sun last summer or over the winter at some point, because in his little column, he was like, oh, congratulations to Mark Shapiro for getting a media gig. He's now writing under the byline Andrew Stoughton at The Athletic. And I'm like, what? Ooh. That's a weird shot to take, but okay. So there's still some animosity, but I think that's from more recent stuff. I don't think that he would have cared what I was writing back then, which I think a lot of them didn't either. But Griff is forever in my good books.
So wait, he's accusing you of shilling for the organization, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
That is an odd...
I found it strange to see my name in a national newspaper in the Toronto Sun for that reason. But, go off. That's fine. I'm sure the lack of respect is mutual, I assure you.
Let me ask you about the Birds All Week podcast. One podcaster to another, you're taking the show behind the paywall at The Athletic. And as a longtime baseball prospectus guy, I've had a lot of experiences with paywalls myself, and they're really a double-edged sword because, on the one hand, they mean you get paid, and that's nice. And you and I were talking before the show, there's some ancillary benefits in terms of production and such that you're going to get from being there, which I envy deeply. I envy more than the money in some ways. But the other side of it, from a creator point of view, is that they can vastly truncate your audience, because even this far into the internet, as we all know, people are reluctant to actually put in their credit card numbers and pay. You've done over 200 episodes of the show before moving. It seemed like you had good support from the Patreon community, your listener community, that allowed you to keep going. Do you have any qualms about making this change?
You know, that's something that we thought about. It was easy for me because I've been at The Athletic for a year now, and I've been on both sides of the divide. And I remember, tweeting when The Athletic started, like, I hope this works, but I would be nervous about going behind the paywall and it not working and then showing up on the other side. And it's like, oh, where's my audience gone? Right. Because really, I mean, you know, if we're gonna talk about the industry and that, you know, I'm basically just monetizing an audience that I've grown over the years, right? And I've taken it to The Score, and I've taken it to, I did a blog called Blue Jays Nation for a thing called the Nation Network that's primarily hockey blogs, and they were excellent that I've worked with for a couple of years, and I've done it on my own, and it's really, you know, I mean, that's really the fundamental exchange, right? So yeah, there were a bit of nerves. You know, when I first saw the concept of The Athletic, but I started freelancing for them because the way that the Nation Network worked was that they're like, we can pay you fairly based on what our numbers are, which means we can't quite pay you enough to, you know, to make a living. And right. It's like, but the alternatives are, you know, the job doesn't exist, or, you know, we do the thing where you get people to write for free. And that's a whole other a whole model that I don't really care for as somebody who hopes to get paid right. doing this. And so they were, you know, but part of what made that work was they would let me freelance, and I did stuff for Vice, and I did stuff for The Athletic as well. And that's, you know, kind of getting in that door and seeing what they're all about and seeing the successes that they were having made that easy for me to make the jump there. And I think that's been really successful, and people have been really supportive. And I know I'm still out there sort of on Twitter. Unfortunately, there's no paywall for Twitter yet, though that might actually not be the worst idea. And yeah, bringing the podcast over, you know, I feel bad because I know that there are people who like genuinely probably can't afford to start throwing money around on things like that. You know, that's just a reality for some people, and I feel bad if they've been left behind, but we tried our best in, you know, dealing with The Athletic and anybody who'd been supporting us financially on Patreon. And you know, we got them a year membership with The Athletic or an extension on their current membership, which I think has gone over very well. And you know, the idea is to sort of push those people who didn't have memberships into the behind the paywall. And I think that's gone well. The pushback has been very, very limited. I hope that means that a lot of them have signed up and a lot of them are going to keep listening. And that as that ecosystem sort of grows within The Athletic app, we're going to find new listeners and you know, be in touch with you know, the stable of talent that they have in order to maybe push us, you know, into the ears of, you know, it didn't work out this week, but the Jays are playing the Giants. We've got Grant Brisby, we've got all sorts of, you know, Andrew Baggerly, great guys covering the Giants there, and that's something that we're, you know, that's sort of our vision of where it's going to go within the app just in general. Yeah, it felt bad about it, but it's also, I don't know, they're paying us, so so we're not really in a position to say no to that. We're like the Aussie Albies of the podcasting world.
Your tolerance for risk, as with Aussie Albies, does change the way, or if you're Randall Grichuk, I guess, wow, changes the equation for you. So, okay, we're getting very near the end. One last, perhaps frivolous question, but as someone who sees some Blue Jays games, but not every Blue Jays game, certainly not 162 games a year, is Teoscar Hernandez's defense as bad as it looks?
If you asked me in the winter, I would say yes. It was atrocious last year. It's been a little bit better this year. He's wearing like yellow tinted glasses. Like he was having trouble picking it up against the sky or in the light, and that was maybe an issue for him. It's still not good. Don't get me wrong, but I mean, last year it was, if they were actually playing for anything, it would have been a nightmare. It would have been so frustrating. I think he got a bit of a pass because last year just turned into such a disaster for the Jays that nobody cared by halfway through the season anyway. But yeah, he really looks like a DH out there in the outfield. I'll tell you that much.
I never mock any outfielder because I don't know about you, but when I played baseball around the neighborhood, I was strictly catcher first base material and wasn't great at that because just genetically quick twitch reflexes just passed me by. So it was just bred out several generations ago, I guess. So I never got too many reps in the outfield. And when I did, it was the most frightening thing in the world. Anyone who's ever had that experience realizes that judging a fly ball against a blank sky is a really difficult thing unless you've done it about a million times. And even then, these guys are judging a ball off the bat, then turning their back on it and running to a spot. So if someone can't do it, I don't fault them at all. But sometimes he really doesn't look like he can't. He really does look like he can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, he makes most of them, but it can be an adventure. Yeah. That's not really a good assessment for a major league outfielder. He doesn't look completely lost. He doesn't look like me out there most of the time.
The publication is The Athletic. My guest has been Andrew Stoughton. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope you enjoy your brand new super prospect when you finally do get him and that he hits like the new Joe DiMaggio or the old Vlad Guerrero. That would work too.
That would be absolutely great. No, it's been fun, man. Thanks very much for having me.
As Birds in Perspex come alive, we have come to the end of another show. You can follow Andrew Stoughton on Twitter at Andrew Stoughton. If you are an early adopter, you got your name. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because there's always another used bookstore to be perused, but you have to go to the bookstore to do it. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, knock, I will let you in, and what happens after that is up to you. Start a discussion of best and worst ballpark foods. That's always an evergreen topic. If you are generously inclined and wish for me to talk about ballpark foods, you can support the show by going to patreon.com/theinfiniteinning. I am very grateful for everyone who has so far and who continues to do so. Thank you so very much. Finally, if you find yourself with a moment to spare, please go to the podcatcher of your choice, Apple, iTunes, or what have you, and rate, review, and subscribe. It helps the show gain attention, and I am very starved for attention. And if your podcatcher does not let you do those things, then hell, remodel your bathrooms under duress. Our theme song, which you are listening to now and have been hearing throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who says, "Vanity is a false cabinet. One thinks he is being modest, but truly his towel's on the floor." Well, if the oatmeal doesn't trick the kettle into pouring its hot water on the cream of wheat and run off into the night screaming, "Ha ha ha, I killed you, Dusty," I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.